Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, we'll be talking to author Kevin Dann about The Road to Walden, 12 Life Lessons from a Sojourn to Thoreau's Cabin. The acclaimed author of Expect Great Things, The Life and Search of Henry David Thoreau, traverses on foot from Manhattan to Walden Pond, retracing Thoreau's steps and unlocking the practical principles of the mystic's life in the woods. When Henry David Thoreau launched his experiment in living at Walden Pond, he began by walking beyond the narrow limits of his neighbors, simply by putting himself at a mile removed from Concord's bourgeois epicenter and 1,000 miles removed from stasis, complacency, and conformity. Kevin Dann emulates and extends Thoreau's experiment in radical self-education. Alternating between personal anecdotes from his spring 2017 pilgrimage and other traveler encounters and episodes told by Thoreau, Dann structures his book around 12 injunctions, distillations of seminal stories about overcoming convention and stasis. In this essential reading for every Thoreau enthusiast, naturalist, and historian, Kevin Dann brings to life an essential American icon in a refreshing and modern way. Kevin's book is available from Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link to his book there in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Kevin to the show. Good day, sir.
Hello, Robert. Thanks for that long and torturous, my road to Walden introduction.
Well, it was a little bit torturous for me in a couple of spots, but that's okay. I overcame them as well as I'm sure you did in your journey as well. So Thoreau, a lot of people, me included, may have had some kind of slight idea of who the man was. But for the listeners who may not know, would you mind sharing just a little bit about who he was to the world? And then, to you, if you have any different, ideas of who the man was.
Sure. Well, Henry David Thoreau is most celebrated for his, I always call it the first indigenous American Gita, if you will, a gospel that he wrote after his 2-year experiment of living at Walden Pond. But yeah, he was an author. He was a surveyor, and he was a great antebellum iconoclast and a member of the so-called Concord Circle, that incredible, tight little brilliant gemstone of individuals who made their home in Concord, either having grown up there or made their way there, most directly to be around the luminary Ralph Waldo Emerson. And all of us, I think, of my generation, have on our lips this word transcendentalist. And transcendentalism. He's one of the celebrated transcendentalists, although we never kind of quite know what that is. To me personally, I read Walden in junior year of high school in English, and I think I was already predisposed to kind of try and find a walking companion, a fellow searcher, and so I was really grateful to have been introduced to him by I had a hippie English teacher named Jim Mura, who was probably himself. You know, it's funny looking back on it. When you're in high school, you're just kind of electrified by certain adults, but you really don't know all that much about them except what you experience in the classroom. But yeah, his enthusiasm for that book, which was I would say safely that it's impenetrable for the average 17-year-old, and it was impenetrable to me. But somehow, what I caught from the pages of the book and what our teacher represented to us, in retrospect now, almost 50 years later, I realize a lot of my life has been sort of unconsciously patterned as much as I could in the late 20th century to follow a kind of Thoreauvian path. I became a naturalist, and I became a writer. I didn't become a surveyor, but and then I had the great opportunity. I was invited at the 200th anniversary of his birth last year to write a biography, which I had never done. And it was a wonderful opportunity to go back and revisit this person who'd been my hero and had slipped away into kind of unconsciousness, but to bring him to consciousness again. And then invited to kind of do book events last year, I thought, well, it would be nice to honor his life by taking a long walk, which was pretty much his method for jarring forth some of his own wisdom. And so we went on this 12-day walk together through New England from my home now in New York City up to Walden Pond. And hopefully, are bringing Thoreau to a new generation of listeners and readers that they don't read him anymore in high school. He's not part of the canon. I found that out teaching college history. I was surprised to find out how many of my students were unacquainted with Thoreau. So, but once the introduction is made, he wins every generation of American searchers' hearts, I believe, and minds.
Yeah, the idea, just that searcher mentality, that's a common, almost a universal feeling or drive within humans. And, if there is an individual who can communicate or stimulate even that seeker within us, then the flame is lit, and then from that point on, I mean, once you start seeking, it's hard to stop.
Yeah. Well, one of the questions last year when I was on the road and doing interviews, everybody always put the question, well, of what relevance could Thoreau be to us today? And if the person who asked the question hadn't already thought about it, it was quite common for us to come to a conclusion that he's never been more relevant. And I think, your listeners, of whatever age, my sense is that those who are older and have remember a time before the distractions and abstractions of the digital world, where life was more direct and simple. It's the prerogative of every generation to have a kind of romantic nostalgia for the way things used to be. But I think it's quite safe to argue that the impact and the inroads that technology have made into all of our lives are a dead reckoning for us. And it's kind of amazing. Thoreau, one of his earliest published pieces was a really, really comical or a satirical piece that he wrote about a kind of utopian, technological utopian fantasy that had been written in an age when, the railroad was coming, the telegraph was coming, and those seem to us simple technologies today, but they were really the beginning of this modern juggernaut that we've all had to adapt ourselves to. And so he was a good technologist himself, right? He helped his father with the pencil manufacturer company that they had, and even made improvements to the manufacturer. And he was handy. You know, he could use tools quite effectively, but with that using of technology, he was quite a trenchant critic of technology, and I think also of luxury. And so the problems mm-hmm. that he was putting before us, and the problems that he was trying to solve in a practical way by demonstrating it through his own life, have just really deepened and sharpened for all of us.
Yeah, very much. Those are very relevant issues today. Now, when you said that you took this sojourn, this walking trip in 2017, how far, you said it was 12 days, how far was that? And just let us kind of know how that was like. I mean, that's quite a trip to make.
Well, somehow I got the pilgrimage habit early. As a junior in high school that summer, I had two friends and I who we hiked the Appalachian Trail, not the entire length, but a significant portion of it in New England. And ever since then, I periodically make some kind of pilgrimage. In 2009, I had walked from Montreal to Manhattan on a peace pilgrimage. And the thing that's funny about whenever you say this, or I say I walked from the foot of Broadway to Walden Pond, you know, people in America are kind of used to a trail walk, you know, such as the Appalachian Trail, most famously. Mm-hmm. But, there's a long tradition in this country of people who made other kinds of, back when you could just walk country roads. So it was about 260 miles, and I kind of mapped it out based on, I made overtures to libraries and to other institutions to say, I want to come to celebrate Henry Thoreau with your community. I'm calling myself the captain of a Huckleberry party, which is famously what Ralph Waldo Emerson in his eulogy for Thoreau, who died quite young at age 44, Emerson said about his friend and protege that Henry could have been captain for all America, but he was content instead to be captain of a Huckleberry party. And, you know, it was a bit of a put-down. Emerson himself was a much more imposing and imperial figure, and Thoreau was content to live his life, I think, and express himself from time to time in public ways, but his own communing at Walden Pond and his sojourns, his walks, were calculated to create a sanctuary, create a sacred space for him to really to talk with the gods, if you will. And I think, you know, for most people who still take long walks, they find this, that there's something about the rhythm and the solitude of a long walk that can bring one into another state of being. It's a wonderful active form of meditation. And so, yeah, I visited these 12 towns, and I brought in my little bag of tricks. I thought Henry Thoreau is kind of this imposing figure, and he himself loved to sing, he loved to dance, he loved to recite poetry, and so that's what I did. I went tripping into these 12 towns with Henry's favorite song I'd committed to memory along the way, and three of his poems that I recited as a riddle, and I suppose I even danced a little bit from time to time. But it was just a beautiful experience to kind of go from place to place and celebrate him in the 200th anniversary year of his birth, and also to hear from people in New England what their relationship was and when it started. And people of all ages came out and shared great stories, and that was a great blessing. And you know, from town to town, it's always interesting. You meet people, you have different things happen, and then you tell the stories about the last town where you were when you reach the next town. And there's something about that that's really such a blessing. It was for me walking, and I've always felt for a long time that America needs a kind of it needs pilgrims. It used to be hitchhikers, you know, back in when I was a kid,
right.
I hitchhiked
right.
back and forth across the country, and it seeded something, you know, to have young people on the road like that. And I think Thoreau had, you know, in his writings, you feel a lot of this, of him encountering strangers and experiencing the kindness of strangers. And there's something about the pilgrim that just by virtue of them traveling freely, it offers a kind of a something in return to the people in those different places.
Yeah, you know, the idea of, you know, going from place to place and telling stories of where you have come from, you know, the places where you've come from, it's really very much like a thread, you know, that connects, you know, community, you know, to community. And, you know, that truly is something that is missing. But, you know, by doing that, you really demonstrate, you know, the interconnectedness of all people just by simply doing that pilgrimage.
Oh, I think so, Robert. And, you know, we're living
mm-hmm.
a period where there's so much that divides people. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
geographically, we have all these divisions as well as socially. And, you know, what we know when we travel is that people are good and people are kind and people
mm-hmm.
want to help. And when you are a stranger, people naturally do that. The odd thing for me is that what I noticed is, you know, when you walk, you're pretty much a freak. I mean, because everyone is in their cars, right?
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. One of the, you know, the most striking things is that when you walk, people are naturally curious. What are you doing? So you don't have to hang a sign or, you know, wear funny clothes or anything like that. But just by virtue of walking,
uh-huh.
you kind of draw attention to yourself.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Now, my daily routine starts with walks in the morning, not pilgrimage kind of walks, but it certainly does fall into that active meditative kind of activity for me. But what I found too is that when I would walk, you know, in a direction that I normally drive, that I would find so many things that I wouldn't have, that I simply passed me by as I was driving. I mean, it's like, I never saw that there, you know, while I was walking. It was like, wow, you know, this, how did I miss that, you know? And I think, you know, just the sense of being on foot, there's a tendency to just be more aware of what, you know, of your surroundings and
yeah, absolutely. All of Thoreau's discoveries were made just simply by walking in a very small
mm-hmm.
corner of New England. He made great discoveries when he went a little further afield, and, you know, to Cape Cod, or his canoe trip with his brother on the Concord Merrimack, or, you know, he eventually towards the end of his life made it out west. But really, his legacy that he left of scientific discovery and of very, very radically insightful social commentary was just mainly by walking. And I always like to say, I used to tell my students that walking is a radical democratic activity because you cross boundaries. And it really
uh-huh.
is a very simple way. Just by walking, we encounter people face to face. And it's the most natural thing in the world, and yet it's becoming not as natural as it used to be, I guess
yeah.
you would say.
Yeah, yeah. And so many communities just aren't built for that activity, you know, and it's a sad thing that, I mean, because it used to be, you know, you could even take the sidewalk to get from point A to point B, and, And, you know, in the city I'm in right now, I mean, rarely are there sidewalks. I mean, it's just enough room for cars. And so it really doesn't, you know, it's just not structured for either walking or even bicycling, you know, the next in between, you know, the walking and driving stage.
Yes. Well, you know, Thoreau was a, you know, he was committed to his place, and you know, to be committed to place itself is something in a restless culture like America, a restless civilization. It was restless then, and it's even more restless now in many different ways. And you know, it's interesting if you think about the proliferation. Just spending a little time on your website and seeing the kind of guests you have and the conversations you have. We have a vast spectrum now of paths for inner exploration, and you know, and wonderfully, so many people are making that inner exploration, and I think it's just great to be reminded that that the inner and the outer, which is what I think Thoreau blended so beautifully, can complement each other. You know, he made great mm-hmm. empirical discoveries. He was, people call him a mystic, but he was just an acutely gifted observer of the natural world, as well as of his social world. And you know, one of the things that I tried to carry on the road with me, because it was the most provocative thing in my biography that I wrote about Thoreau. Mm-hmm. It's a discovery I made in some way. What I committed to is, I said, you know, given the task of trying to say something new about him, I thought, well, he was a phenomenologist, and that's a fancy way of saying he stuck to what was before him, what he could observe with his senses, and he didn't import very convoluted theories, but he was truly a gifted observer and describer of things. And so I thought, well, he left this journal of 2 million words. I'll just read his journal, you know, raw. And maybe through the journal I will make discoveries about him as if I were walking in the landscape and mm-hmm. and just really trying to be keenly aware of what I'd seen. And I made a discovery that got me in a lot of trouble along the way, which was that, you know, I sensed very strongly that he actually had a clairvoyance for the beings of nature. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about nature as a kind of abstract object out there, but that these invisible beings of the natural world approached him, and that he had a relationship with them right through the time when he was out at Walden Pond, when he was in his late 20s, and also with other spiritual beings. And he was a guy who famously, Emerson said about him that he talked like he wrote, or his writing and his speaking were of a piece. If anyone who spent any time reading Thoreau knows he had this great gift for wordplay, for punning. He loved to pull off double entendres, and it's dense for us, that writing is dense for us today. So if we imagine dropping out to the Walden Pond and spending an afternoon with Henry, we might think it would have been hard to follow his thought. But if you can ride on it, it's rhythmic, it's absolutely beautiful, and it also makes this, it's always, as he put it, catching two fish on one hook. That was his method, was he loved to speak and act in a way that brought the spiritual world and the physical world together. And catching two fish on one hook for him was, I think, through doing what transcendentalism is supposed to be all about, which was through the commonplace of the surroundings, find his way to spiritual beings. So I'm beating around the bush, but what I really said is that Thoreau was clairvoyant for the fairy world, for the elemental beings of nature. And that's something that really was fun to bring on the road with me, because I did this by way of a riddle. I recited these three poems that speak about, in a very respectful and kind of hushed tones way, about his encounters with these beings, and presented it as a riddle, and it was very difficult for people to figure out. But once we had disclosed it, it was so interesting, because occasionally I would have people come forth and always in private reveal to me that they had had experiences of these beings as well. Never publicly, but privately.
Right.
So here I'm hanging ten with you, Robert. I feel like you're a convivial host where I might share that. I feel like this realm of clairvoyance and for experience of other beings was part and parcel of what the Transcendentalist Project was about, and yet we've gone so far away from that we're shy, and especially in the academic world, it's pretty much taboo to say such things.
Yeah, well, you're certainly correct in that. You know, I'm right there with that. I mean, as a matter of fact, that was, you know, my next question or comment. You know, in that book, that part fascinated me. You know, to me, it was one of those areas I would never have guessed. You know, that his perception of those individuals or entities or beings was part of his nature, and that, you know, it seems that his connection with nature and being open to what it offers is one of those areas where, first of all, like you say, we've kind of really grown away from that. But for those people who, you know, do focus on connection with nature and various realms, that, you know, there is that experience. There is, you know, and, you know, to me, it's just fascinating because, I mean, you know, we have such a historical references to these realms, and we look at them as mythology. But then so many myths had their beginnings in perceptions of the individuals at that time.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I was raised as I studied biology. I worked as a outdoor educator and, you know, studied science, did a bit of science along the way before I became a historian. And so I had to make a big leap. But it was really through my own observations. I mean, this is, again, about sticking to the phenomena. My own daughter, encountering her encounters with the beings of nature, and then eventually having lots of experiences with other people who had this gift. And I think it's funny because, you know, my own reverence for Thoreau from the beginning was his reverence and his closeness to nature, and yet if one allows that there are beings who stand behind nature, which was what the Transcendentalist Project was all about, then to actually to cultivate and have a clairvoyance for that, that at the time when he was writing, and it wasn't something that you could say in polite company, right? So he figured out a way to communicate it. And one of the things I found and celebrated in my biography of Thoreau was that he found a way to share that with young people. He wanted them to have that experience as well, if they could, to make it possible for them. So there's a there's an interesting legacy that probably we could find in others as well. But science is a science, and the scientific and sometimes materialist mindset is a very harsh taskmaster, and is very good at making people shy about sharing their own experience. I think what's interesting about Thoreau is he was somebody who had a rich inner private life, and the folklore and the sort of the rules of thumb for dealing with that realm have always been that one speaks indirectly, one doesn't speak directly, one sees them out of the corner of one's eye or hears them, you know, somewhat indirectly. And so you don't shout it from the rooftops. You just, it's if you followed that rule of thumb, it's a beautiful rule of thumb for how to become a witness in the natural world that just in the material realm will make you a more acute observer and also someone who can add rather than detract from the natural world, that there's a kind of reverence and respect there that translates whether you believe in fairies or not, to come with an open heart and an attentive, silent presence is pretty much a universal prescription, I think, for making discoveries and revelations of any sort for anybody.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and the idea of making his ideas accessible to the young. You mentioned your daughter. I mean, you know, the young are just so open, you know, to, you know, perception. Of what they see. They haven't been taught not to see, you know, and so so often, you know, that's you know, that's one of those things that really, if fostered into with a child, can really be very beneficial, you know, later in life when it comes to just perceiving the intricacies, you know, of human nature and of nature. So it's you know, it's just one of those things where that I think there are a lot of authors, artisans, you know, of the past, you know, had their own workaround, you know, to be able to get the message out.
Mm. Well, when Thoreau was quite young, when he first began his journal as a, you know, late teens, he was at the time, he was very interested in magic and myth. And that was, you know, that was very, it's funny, you know, we live in an era now when Harry Potter has for a generation almost really been the most popular story in the world, and all the other stories of magic that young people are steeped in today. So there's this a natural affinity, I think, with an universal affinity between adolescence and magic. And of course, magic, we've been taught to say that magic is just something that's illusion, and it's something that it's something those poor primitive people used to believe in, and yet we have magical things happen to us, and it was quite stunning for me the at the very beginning of Thoreau's journal, the very first story he tells, a personal story he tells, is one where he says, a funny thing happened to me about 6 weeks ago. And he stops and interjects this story about being out for a walk with his brother John. And Thoreau was talking about the native people of Concord, and they're walking along a riverbank, and he says, in a flourish, he says to his brother John, there stood Tahatan's hut, and there is Tahatan's arrowhead, and he reaches down to pick up a stone, and when he lifts up the stone, it's a perfect arrowhead. So 6 weeks later, he's still a little bit unnerved by this experience, and he's aware that something magical happened, that he had literally conjured it through his words. And it's quite uncanny, because dozens of times in Thoreau's journals, he says something to the effect, in the long run, we find what we expect. We shall be fortunate then if we expect great things. And that's the motto, the personal motto that gave me the title for my biography of Henry Thoreau. And yet he himself didn't recognize, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but because I've had experiences like this in my life, where I have thought of something, and within 24 hours, something outlandish that I've wanted, you know, it's been my heart's desire to have, and it's usually in a very particular realm. And Thoreau had the same thing happen to him with arrowheads, with rare plants, with music boxes. He said, I must have some muse in my employ, because he could merely think of these things and they would come to him. Well, that's a magical act. That's the basis of magic, when we think of something and it manifests in the physical world. So there must be some invisible intermediaries there. And of course, a lot of people in the modern world have spent a lot of time and effort to try and figure out just what that is. Well, for most of human history, they called them fairy gifts. And from the respectable folk, Robin Goodfellow, that one has these invisible spiritual beings that have a very close relationship to us. And those things that are closest to our heart can manifest themselves magically. You know, we have lots of different authors out there that have unfortunately taken this in a little bit of a twisted direction, like, you know, Rhonda Byrne and The Secret, and a lot of more materialist interpretations of this. But this is the oldest golden rule everywhere on the planet, which is that if we have a destiny, and if we're true and faithful to our inner voice, that we will get spiritual aid. And it can manifest in the most capricious and delightful ways. And I think that Thoreau lived in a time when the borderline there was still just porous enough that even if he had to ponder and say, was that, you know, what was that? How did I do that? How did I manifest that? And how did I manifest it in other instances? As a storyteller, I feel like I have a sacred obligation to share those kinds of stories when I've had those sort of things happen to me, because they're quite wonderfully evocative. It gets people to remember such things that have happened to them that they've put aside, just the way a dream can, after you have a dream, unless you write it down and tell others about it, it can feel like it didn't happen to you. Well, that's just, a dream is a spiritual experience. So spiritual experiences are gossamer. They're like that very fine material that it's not really of the physical world, so it doesn't register in our memories and in our body the way physical experiences do. And I think as a biographer, that's one of the things that's such a great invitation, that you can choose to find those things that are gossamer, but that really it's these finer and more transient and things that often are the place where you find the real individual, not just in their everyday workaday lives.
Yeah, you know, you're right, and you know, when you find them and know that you've experienced them, you know, that's when that commonality is really, you know, really what an author, I mean, if an author can tap into and communicate that, that's, like you say, what stimulates the reader, you know, into remembering. And then, you know, it's basically raising awareness. It's just, you know, once it's in the, you know, that idea of in forethought, you know, that people can co-create that particular experience for themselves. And then when it happens again, then there's a heightened sense of acknowledgement. And then it just, you know, to me, when that happens, it just seems to, multiply. You know, I mean, once you experience it, recognize, acknowledge, give gratitude, it happens again. It's like, okay, you know, Robert, paying attention. So we're going to give him a few more of those.
Yeah. Well, Thoreau said, know your own bone, gnaw on it, and gnaw it still. And there's something, you know, he was, for all of his kind of rarefied inner life, he had a gift for the pithy metaphor. And, you know, he was very rooted in a 19th century world of, some real raw experiences of work and of the earth. And gnawing on that bone, one's own inner marrow, that's what he did. His life, short as it was, is a beautiful demonstration that, you know, he marched to a different drummer, and he kept faithful to his own inner convictions. He had a kind of martial sense about him that, you know, famously landed him in jail for refusing to pay the poll tax. And it's quite amazing that such a small gesture, which probably to him was just so easily consistent with who he was, and yet that, you know, we learn that it inspired both Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, that civil disobedience essay has had this extraordinary life, and to give people inspiration to stick with their convictions and go against the common grain, which never is the common grain the one that leads. It's always the narrow path, the one that is critiqued and often scoffed at by one's neighbors, that is the one that actually leads through to the future. So every generation can draw tremendous inspiration from him, I believe.
I agree. So now, regarding the supernatural, you mentioned, first of all, you know, that we talked about that different realm, fairy realm, and realms of nature, and also his idea that, you know, he maybe had that muse helping him achieve or find or obtain things that he wanted. Did he have any other particular views of the supernatural, maybe, beyond those couple topics?
Well, it was an era when mesmerism and then spiritualism after 1848 was exploding all over America. And he kept that very much at arm's length. I think he was very distrustful of mediumistic experiences, which was kind of that was the experimental realm for people to contact spiritual beings. But he was very, very not only skeptical of it, but also distrustful of, because a lot of the way that manifested was people then turned these voices, these disembodied voices, and into sort of guides for living, and they had pretty capricious advice. And he saw it as quite materialistic, and there was a lot of spectacle to it. And I think his way was much more of a monastic and ascetic practice of cultivating of silence and attentiveness, that he, seeing and hearing, could come that way. But your question is such a good one, Robert. I would say that's why I found it interesting, is that he was so devoted to the physical world and not drawn into this thing that was quite popular in his time, both in spiritualism and also even, say, Freemasonry. You know, there are a whole plethora of these kinds of practices that were out there. And he was, I think, forging a kind of a unique path of nature study that promised what transcendentalism supposedly promised, which was through nature, through the physical world, to the spiritual world that stood behind it. And he actually had that experience. And we never really have given him credit for that. And again, others might disagree with me that that's what his experience was. But it shows up in so many different places in his life and in his writings that he had, if you just read a few pages of any of his work, he subtly suggests that he is communing with other beings. And and that's something we need to take seriously, I think, because I think we have it's not just something that was of his time, but it's of our time as well.
Yeah, I agree. No, I've and it's funny because I can understand his reluctance to kind of be swept up into that fervor at the time. I had years ago, I had a friend in San Diego whose grandparents were like osteopathologists. And anyway, they had a whole bunch of old information they thought that they found in their place thought I would like. And in it, I found the National Spiritualist Association newsletters from the 20s and 30s. And it was just very interesting. I mean, they had, you know, articles about Mark Twain's experiences, but I mean, it was a fervor. I mean, it truly was, you know, it was just kind of, I mean, as I was reading it, it was kind of like I could tell, you know, being in that time, that was the thing to do. And, you know, in the mediumship aspect and, you know, when I look at, you know, today with people who I kind of connected with those in the metaphysical realm, and there are people who I know who very much have that Thoreau experience of connecting with beings, you know, and just that internal calmness and sanctity, you know, that they have when they're kind of in that space. And then there are those who are very much in that fervor aspect. And you know, I mean, it's just clear to me that there is just such a distinction. And those that in the, you know, that are in the fervor realm, who shout and yell and scream and hey, I'm here. That's what I think leads those from the scientific or the skeptical realm to question validity, you know, and those who, like Thoreau, are nice and still and quiet and prefer the personal experience, don't do that shouting. I mean, they're content on experiencing personally, and you know, and that's good for them. And so, to me, it's kind of funny that we, you know, we have this dual kind of experience or you know, pronunciation of the, you know, of the experience, and it's those that yell that you know that get the attention. But I think that's changing. I think, you know, there are more and more, like, you know, Thoreau, who have the personal experience, and I've had some people on the show who are, you know, scientists by profession, who shift their, you know, view based on personal experience. I had a gentleman who was an anesthesiologist, and his son died very young under anesthesia. So, I mean, it was, you know, particularly shaking for him, but he ended up having this connection, you know, this past life connection. I mean, it was just one of those things where he realized that he, you know, because he personally experienced it, that he maybe had to open up to and maybe shift his ideas. And I think more and more scientific people are having that personal experience, and when they do, that helps, you know, the skeptics out there say, okay, well, you know, I know this so and so, and you know, if he says it, then maybe I should really think about it.
Yes. And, you know, I always like to cite the example of that Thoreau, when he was out at Walden Pond, one of the things he did was he'd grown up in this town where everybody said that Walden Pond was bottomless. And so the first winter he was there, he just went out on the ice and augured with a drill through the ice in many dozens of places, and then dropped his lead plumb bob down on a line, fishing line, and till it hit bottom, and then he mapped the bottom of the pond. And, you know, it's quite amazing to think of in 1845, everyone was content to just say, oh, it's a bottomless pond. And he simply went out and by measurement, which he had a knack for, he not only discovered that it wasn't bottomless, but he discovered that if you draw a line between the longest dimension of the pond and the shortest dimension, where they intersect, those two lines, will be the deepest part of the pond. And it turns out that's a general law for inland waters. And so he didn't take hearsay. He went out and he experienced something. And not only did he overturn convention, but then he discovered something that was a kind of a general law. Well, when you have somebody who is so, you know, and he famously was the one who really discovered what the nature of succession is, was in the New England forest between oak and pine trees, and by observation over, you know, many, many seasons to see how the squirrels were working and how the growth patterns of those two very different trees were progressing. So it's always better if you're an acute and reliable observer of nature's secrets, then you can maybe hushed whispered tones, you can you can talk about an even deeper secret that's there. And I have no doubt that the coming generations will help us to move into that world that has been very much secret, and we'll have new generations of scientific discoveries in nature. Is still waiting to be explored and appreciated for all of us. It's ever new and ever inviting of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I have faith in that younger generation too. There have been I had a couple siblings on the show who have a nonprofit to save endangered species. You know, I mean, they're one of these, you know, they go around the world talking to young people about saving extinct or, you know, those on the endangered species list for one more generation, which is the name of their nonprofit. You know, it's, and I think that the children don't close down as quickly as we used to, or they're not the indoctrination, like I mentioned about, there've been, you know, they don't know to say, you know, it can't exist, or, you know, they haven't been conditioned yet to accept things as they are and instead look beyond. I think that's a trait that, you know, is just getting more popular. And I think, you know, once we see, you know, once the young people see their peers making great strides or doing great things, then it's just like a snowball that they're going to go ahead and others are going to pick up on it. And well, if they can do that over there in, you know, South Africa, then I can do that here. Why not?
Truly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I hope that we have a whole cadre of new civilly disobedient and respectfully reverent young people,
and
it's one of the great gifts that America has given to the world is its penetration of nature. And it did that in the scientific realm, and I think it's now time that the coming generations will extend all that really acute empiricism. We'll have definite and fine-grained a picture of the fields of the spiritual world as we do of the fields out there in the physical world. That's the descriptions and the spiritual science that awaits us on the horizon, I think.
I agree. Well, so we're down to the end of the show already. So what do you hope that the people who read Expect Great Things are going to take away from, reading the book?
Well, I hope they'll develop an intimacy with Henry Thoreau, that they'll feel like he's a friend who can speak to them across the generations, and inspire some pilgrimages of the sort that I took, and that they can, every single reader has the opportunity to make discoveries right around them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I enjoyed the book a lot. There were just so many things I learned that it was just very interesting reading, and it was one of those that, I took my time going through it because I wanted to make sure I absorbed it, but I really enjoyed your book, Kevin.
Well, Robert, thanks so much for the conversation, and we'll see you out there on the road.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Kevin Dann. We've been talking about his book, Expect Great Things, The Life and Search of Henry David Thoreau. Again, you can find his book on Amazon, and I do have a direct link to his book there in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show, and until we meet again... Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.